Blog Talk Radio.
Room 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. Hey, Danielle, it's 4 o'clock p.m. in the East Coast. Yep, it's time for Backroom Politics, live from Chili's Backroom on Blog Talk Radio, the weekly political discussion on everything inside the Beltway, outside the Beltway, and everything that affects you and your person at your home and overseas. With us, as they are every Tuesday, is our usual roundtable of political pundits. To my left, he is the former eight-term member of Congress from Washington State's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former vice president of government affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad, longtime Inside the Beltway pundit. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Al, welcome back.
Thank you very much. I have a question.
What is that?
Why is our round table square?
That's a very good question. I got nothing on that one, Al. Directly in front of me, he is the former staff chief on the floor for Congressman Gerald Ford. He's a former vice president of the National Broadcasting Company, NBC. Former vice president or former member of the board for the National Association of Broadcasters and longtime political insider. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Bob, welcome back.
Always glad to be here. There's no place like Shelley.
That's right. And to my right, he is our international affairs pundit. He is the vice president of the Eurasia Center and a bar certified attorney in the District of Columbia and the great state of New York. He is Dr. Ralph Whitty. Ralph, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Glad to be here. And I have to ask you.
Yes.
Ni shui de zhong wen de shi ho.
Yes.
When are you going to study Chinese?
Get me Rosetta Stone. We'll talk. Yeah, okay. I am your moderator, Justin Russell. This is Backroom Politics. We've got a lot of stuff going on, as we do every Tuesday here on the show. We've got a lot of stuff going on over the past week. The big talk around town over the past few days was last Friday. I can tell you right now, I was personally here in Shelley's back room, as I am most every day. But on Friday, it was a little tense. A lot of political insiders sitting here drinking their drinks, smoking their cigars, watching their Blackberries, waiting for the announcement. Are we going to shut the government down, or can we, in fact, strike a deal? Well, at about 10:30 last Friday night, it was announced that a deal had been struck. The White House and the leadership in Congress have come together and come up with a six-month solution to the fiscal year 2011 budget. Yet, as is the case with everything political in this town, there's a lot of grumbling about that. Bob, we were talking before the show. You've been hearing a lot of buzz about the deal and what was in it, what was not in it, and there's a lot of people that still don't completely understand what, in fact, was in the deal.
Absolutely right. I've been listening to a few people on Capitol Hill, and I gathered that on both sides of the aisle, there are people who are seeing for the first time the full details of what the agreement is, rather than just the outlines of the money and a few other things. And there are more than a few people probably more Democrats than Republicans, but there are more than a few people who are unhappy. with their leadership for the agreement that they've got to take care of.
And
it's a problem.
And it's always the case. This is, by the way, a live call-in show. You are welcome to join the conversation, ask questions of our roundtable, offer comments about anything political. It's an open forum. You can call us at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477 to join the conversation. Keeping on the topic of the budget, Al, have you heard any buzz about what was going on or how that deal went down?
I haven't been on the Hill a lot this week, and no, I haven't, but I trust what Bob said. And my reaction to it is, oh, for crying out loud, grow up. Did you expect to be satisfied with any deal that they came up with? Was there any deal they could have come up with that would have been satisfactory on Capitol Hill? The answer is no.
No.
So forget it and get on to the next thing. I think it will be helpful to find out what it is specifically they object to, so as they go into what the real game is in this town, which is the 2012 budget, they can kind of watch out for how they handle those things. But people who are whining about this are crying over yesterday's spilt milk.
You know, it's funny because we, as we sit here and we watch all the events unfold last Friday and the spillover into yesterday and even today, we're starting to see a lot of backlash, which I have to admit was a strong showing of what we have been touting here on this show for months, and that's compromise. There were compromises made in getting the deal done, and some of them were easy to swallow, some of them not so much. And Ralph, I'm not sure what you've heard, but I got to tell you something. The compromises went into play, and as such, you know, not everybody's going to be happy. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think one of the main issues they were able to compromise was because they didn't want the troops to suffer. So the whole issue with funding of the troops was very important, especially to members of the Tea Party. That being said, there's still about 28 members of the Republican caucus that did not want to compromise at all and were hoping for a government shutdown.
I got to say, that politically, Al, does not seem like the right strategy or even the right message to put out, especially when Congress has approval ratings now in the 20s, and you're going all in on a government shutdown. Does that even make sense politically?
No, and it's been proven twice. It was proven once under Ronald Reagan, who shut it down. It was the administration that shut it down, but we're able to blame Congress for it.
Right.
Then Newt Gingrich shut it down, and everybody blamed Congress for it. And if they'd done it this time, everybody would have blamed Congress
right.
for it. And the Tea Party people in particular, and the freshmen and what it is, simply haven't been here long enough to see how certain things play out. This one is a no-brainer.
Bob, you really think that the freshman class that recently came in was that vocal, that strong of a collective that they could have theoretically shut this government down for a time?
I am not close enough inside to know, but it's clear to me that in the last 3 months, 2 months, while we've had continuing crises of whether we're going to close it down or not, and we've always been able to avoid it, I'm pretty sure from what I've heard over that period of time that a lot of the Tea Partiers feel extremely firm in their view that they're here to cut the budget, and the biggest number they can get is a minimum number as far as they're concerned. They fundamentally believe that $100 billion in deficit reduction that we're going to get if we get elected, we're going to make it happen, is, in their mind, a promise they've made, and they've been trying to keep it.
And there's some truth to that, but, you know, we cannot run a country without a budget, and we're the laughingstock of people in the international community. I mean, the great United States, and they can't come together and pass the budget.
Well, I mean, running this far, I can't remember in modern times, and Bob and Al, you guys have been here a lot longer than many of us. here in Washington.
I had lunch with George Washington just the other day.
It's in your mind, right?
It's funny you say that because this morning on Morning Joe on MSNBC, one of the things that they learned during the day was that Pat Buchanan was there during the first shots on Fort Sumter, and he's here to talk about it. You guys have been here a lot longer. I can't remember a time when a fiscal budget has gone literally 6 months into the fiscal year on continuing resolution and amendment to that CR. It's a bad precedence to set, in my opinion. Am I looking at that wrong, Al? Or
no, you're right in your first point, as far as my history of Congress goes. And I think you're right in your second point. I think it's a terrible precedent. And it's based upon not understanding the process. I mean, clearly, what they should have been doing, it seems to me I would have advised the Tea Party, is take what you can get on this one and then get ready for the big fight. You know, and that's what they had to settle for. They could have made themselves look a lot better by doing it sooner.
You know, Al is exactly right, I think, because there are two upcoming votes on fiscal matters that are absolutely vital and have to be passed, and there is no shirking it. Number one, the one that's going to come first is going to come up within the next 2 months, because we are butting up against the ceiling of our debt, and we have got to raise the debt ceiling. If we don't, we will begin a process of doing a little bit of maybe not paying our bill.
And we're going to talk about that, because that's the next fine. I mean, it just seems right now that once we clear one fiscal hurdle in on the Hill and in government, there's two more behind it.
Yep.
And that is sending. I mean, in reality, the budget, although political, should not be a political chip that people can cash in on the Hill. And it seems to me that this is becoming more and more of a standard operating procedure rather than the abnormality of a strange fiscal discussion. And we're getting, you know, with the current fiscal crisis in America right now, with the current financial condition of our country, playing with the budget for 6 months is definitely something that we should really take note of and should get that message back to the Hill. Now, the question is, if people understood how dangerous that was, can that message go to the Hill? And my question to you is, would they listen, Al? Would that be something that would resonate with the elected officials?
I don't think so. I've had a theory all along that what has really got the public upset, everyone's saying the American people, what really has them upset is that Congress can't do anything. It's the bickering, the back and forth, the backbiting, the snapping, the juvenile behavior. So we just did another one. And now we're going to go into one, and I don't see any way they're going to avoid looking bad dealing with the debt ceiling. And I don't see how they're going to do anything but look bad. And then comes the election. And I'm very interested on how either party plans to blame this fiasco on the other one.
Ralph. Well, I think Obama was trying to look presidential by telling Boehner and Reid to start acting like grown-ups and compromise and get a budget passed. Because it's inexcusable for this Congress not to have any kind of budget and to have taken so long. But you've got people on both sides that are just unwilling to compromise.
Well, you know, when we look at all the cuts that came out there were compromises on both sides. The big one that we talked about last week was the funding of Planned Parenthood. And my understanding, and folks correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was that the Planned Parenthood debate was called out by saying, look, we won't fund it. However, we are going to have a study on how future funding will be utilized by that organization.
A classic compromise study.
Yeah, it was. It was. But we also saw liberals take a hit. EPA was cut by $3 billion. That's a tremendous hit to that agency. But yet we also saw the race to the top funding increase in the deal, which was almost an olive branch to the president saying, look, we can compromise with you too. What were some of the other hot ticket items that you saw in the compromise that came up that got your attention, Bob?
Oh boy, I don't know that I have any specific one that I feel strongly about it. The big thing was the amount of the money. From the standpoint of the Democrats, I think they felt that every place they turned, money was being chopped out from the programs that they like.
Right.
And there was no effort to do anything else. So, I think basically, looking at it as a whole, I think the Democrats legitimately feel that they paid a pretty damn heavy price to get the budget in place for the last 6 months of this fiscal year.
Now, correct procedural question. Correct me or answer this question for me. The question then comes to, in the deal, is it actually a budget ratification that will now go to conference, or is this does it basically eliminate the fiscal year 2011 budget and just have the funding of the government as it operates on a continuing resolution through the year?
The budget resolution that they have agreed to has to be passed by both houses of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And the House is going to do it, I think, on Thursday or Friday, and the Senate will follow the next day or right away afterwards.
But there will be no traditional conferencing of this budget deal.
No, there's no, they're not going to, I don't think they're going to, obviously, if you open it up to amendment, my God. That's the last thing you'd
want to
have.
Alice, is this open for amendment, do you know?
No, it can't be open for amendment. It's a deal that has been cut by leadership, and leadership controls the Rules Committee and the Senate.
There will be a couple of hours of debate, and that'll be it. Yeah.
So it will be funded through September, then?
Through September.
Right. I mean, 6 months will give us well into almost the 2012 budget, which is almost a red flag that says, guess what, we've got another fight coming on.
What would you like to bet that on October the 1, we won't have a budget for 2012?
I won't take that bet. I still owe you for the last bet we did.
That's right. That's
Al, does that give you pause to know that they funded the government for 6 months, knowing the fact that we're about to get into a very valid discussion on the 2012 budget? That's got to cause you some concern.
It doesn't cause me any concern. It means they've cleared the deck so they could get down to what is really important. I mean, where they're going to be really coming to grips. And they're going to be, and it's going to be open, at least at the outset. This is not going to be the leadership meeting behind closed doors, as was true with the other one. That's the reason you get people bitching and moaning up there. I didn't know that was in there. Of course they didn't. But much more of the 2012 budget is going to be open warfare, fights on things. People are going to know primarily what's in it, at least down to the last few days, when who knows, the leadership may have to come in and hammer something out.
Is this the benchmark for more transparency in the budget process?
I don't know that. That the two are connected in any way. It's just that by its very nature, the budget process is at the outset more open.
They're going to have to hold hearings on budget resolutions. Now, the Republicans have a resolution in the House, but the Democrats have, and I gather the president is going to, is it tomorrow he's going to lay his proposal on the table? It'll obviously be somewhat different than what his budget. What his budget proposal was 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. And so it'll be different now, and that's going to have to move through the House. It's got to go through the Senate. You're going to have votes in both houses, and the Senate will be, and you can amend it. The resolutions at this stage, you'll be able to amend them if they don't close off amendments on the floor, and I doubt that they will in both houses. So you'll have an opportunity to, fight this thing through. And I'm willing to bet we won't have a budget for the next fiscal year on the day the fiscal year starts.
So it comes down to a clash of ideologies at that point.
Sure. We're talking about the Tea Party people are enabled now, if you will. I mean, they've done, I think, something that I'll bet a lot of them didn't think they could do, and they've been successful. And I can't imagine that they're going to be suddenly go gently into that sweet night. I think they're going to be a little more rambunctious.
But they have to. But they have to understand that they're also have been. They've also been sent there to get things accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely.
Al, you were kind of giving a look.
The thing that really troubles me is nobody is taking the time to sit down and explain to the American public how badly the crisis, how bad the crisis is, that this is not something that we may choose to do, it is something we have to do. And it's going to hurt. And it's going to hurt like hell. And it's going to hurt everybody. I mean, I cannot imagine how we're going to solve the problem without some tax increases. Hopefully, they'll be pinpointed and responsible and so forth. And we're going to have some cuts in some programs that even the most Rockward Republican would probably not want to cut if he had his druthers. So my point is, somebody needs to talk to the American public so they can understand this debate and what it's all about.
Well, we're going to take a break right now. We're at 20 after the hour. When we come back, we're going to continue the discussion on the budget. But I want to get into the 2012 budget, and I also want to talk about the debt ceiling when we come back. That is going to be the next big hurdle, and I think that's going to have as much, if not a little bit more, impact on everybody than the media and the Hill are getting out there that everybody thinks. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room in downtown Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Thank you. And we're back here live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. If you're joining us from our last segment, and again, please, if you want to call in, ask the roundtable any questions, you can do so at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Continuing on the discussion that we had from earlier on the budget and the fiscal issues facing not only Washington but just about everybody in the country, want to talk a little bit about how we, as we clear this hurdle, which is the 2011 budget, we start looking at the other fiscal issues. The big one looming right now is the increase in the debt ceiling, something that even President Obama, as a senator, voted against. But it looks even more imminent that it's something that has to be done. Al, you're kind of shrugging a little bit. What is the importance of raising the debt ceiling?
I'm not shrugging. I'm praying on my hands that it's not obvious to everybody that it has to pass. You see, here's an analogy that was used clear back in Reagan's years that I thought always had a lot of merit. What you do by raising the debt ceiling is you say you can pay off obligations you've already made. Saying you won't raise it is like saying, I'm not going to pay off my credit card. Well, if you didn't want to pay off your credit card, you shouldn't have charged all the things on it. And so this is a question of whether we're going to pay off our credit card or not. And when you put it that way, it's pretty damn simple.
Well, you know, Bob, using that analogy, using the credit card analogy, it then seems that, you know, hey, we've hit our credit limit.
We're at it.
We're our credit limit, you know, we're $200 away from credit limit. That's a bar tab for me. How do we get around it? I mean, basically we're asking the bank to increase our credit limit.
Well, what we're doing, and Ralph can speak to this with some specificity, but there are a whole lot of people who hold a whole lot of debt of ours. And if we're not paying our bills, so to speak, they're not going to be buying any more of our bonds.
And Ralph, that turns into the international effect of, you know, China, Japan, not to mention several of the EU countries. What kind of effect is that going to have internationally?
First of all, Japan is going to be cashing their T-bills to pay for the damage from the earthquake.
Right.
What's happening now in Russia and China is they no longer use the dollar as their reserve currency in their domestic industries.
What effect does that have on us?
Well, it's sending a message to other countries to divest themselves from the dollar. The dollar is a weak currency. And to start looking at other more stable currencies.
What would be some of those stable currencies? Are we talking about going to the euro? Are we talking about maybe looking at the yen, at
Canadian,
the ruble?
Canadian dollar. OPEC is looking at this very closely, because if we raise our debt ceiling and there's no effort to bring our fiscal situation under control, what's going to happen is they're going to start divesting themselves away from the dollar and looking at more of an oil-based currency, similar to along the lines of the Canadian dollar. Those are the two strongest right now.
Well, you know, we saw what happened in Ireland. Ireland attempted to raise their debt ceiling. They dissolved their government, and then when the new government came in, they basically said, we're not paying it. And a lot of people said, well, no, you have to. And the Irish government said, we're not paying it.
What's kept the U.S. in the ballgame is so many currencies are inextricably linked to the dollar. Now what you're seeing is China and Russia, since they have divested themselves from the dollar as their reserve currency, you're going to see other countries starting to make a similar move.
Well, what's going to happen to Ireland? They just said, we're not paying our credit card debt.
Someone's going to come in and bail them out. Maybe it's the EU, maybe it's another institution.
That's a dangerous game they're playing on,
right?
What is a large part of the EU gross national product.
Well, you can damage yourself. I mean, if you don't pay your bills, I mean, it's just like going, you know.
It's like having a credit, a bad credit rating.
Yeah, it's like you won't be able to buy a house because you can't give a bad credit rating. You won't be able to do anything internationally because you got a bad, because you've welched on your obligation.
But when you look at a lot of the isolationist talk, for example, coming out of the Rand/Ron Paul camp, is that necessarily a bad thing? I mean, we've heard Ron Paul say, and I'm paraphrasing, so what? We don't up the debt ceiling. All we'll do is we'll finance ourselves. We'll do everything domestically. The heck with the rest of the world. Is that a smart play?
Well, I don't think that's a smart play. I don't think it's a smart play what the Irish are doing. The Irish is a very small country. And relatively speaking, it would be easier to bail them out, as you say. When you get around to the United States, you're not going to have anybody wanting to bail us out.
And we've got a phone call on the line. 818 area code, you're on live with Backroom Politics. What's your comment, sir? Hello? Eight 818 area code, you're on the air. 818, we're going to put you on hold and come back to you. Stay with us. If we're talking about, if in fact we are talking about raising the debt ceiling, raising the credit limit, you know, for us both domestically and internationally, at some point, and Ralph, this is probably best for you, we're going to have to sit there and look at, you know, the international trade deficit that we're experiencing now is just unfathomable. For one of the strongest industrial nations in the world, for us to have an international trade deficit like we do is just unconscionable. How do we get around that, or can we?
Well, you're going to have to start by getting your fiscal situation in order, which means a lot of draconian cuts. Going to be a lot of sacrifices that are going to have to be made among both Republicans and Democrats to their core constituencies. But you're going to have to get our fiscal situation in order. I can't say it any stronger than this. It affects us internationally.
Al,
and going back to my analogy of the credit card and that you've already spent the money, I think that we should hear with every new suggestion, we should have somebody say, do you realize come next year, this will add X amount of dollars to how much we're going to have to raise the credit limit? In other words, get people thinking about this boat way back when they're spending the money, not after they've spent it.
Absolutely.
Bob?
Well, you know, there's a GE had a nice little one-liner when I was working for NBC, and NBC was owned by GE in those days. They had a one-liner. Is it nice to do, or do you need to do it, or is it just nice to do it? And we're going to have to ask that question. There's a whole lot of things that are good to do, nice to do. If we have the money, we want to do them. But it's coming down to the point where, at least for some period of years, we're going to have to be very hard-nosed about spending money on things that we'd like to do, that would be good to do, but we can't afford to do it because we can't afford to pay the bill.
And there's another category in there, and that is investment. Now, you can figure out an investment argument for almost anything you want to spend money on. But there are some things that are true investments, and if we don't make them now, we're going to lose out in some way.
What are those investments, Al?
Well, I happen to be, and this is very debatable, but I happen to be a huge fan of high-speed rail. And I think we're going to be sucking wind in a few years in our transportation mode with virtually every, even developing country.
You're right. We have a very antiquated infrastructure.
Which is falling apart.
No, let's go back to the switchboard. Let's try 818 area code. You're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Right on. How you doing, guys?
Fine. How are you?
Great, great. The whole notion, and I understand, I mean, I'm here in Los Angeles, which is, and I, you know, I'm a conservative myself, and I'm, you know, we don't find too many of us out here in this area. And for some reason, I think the problem is the public is just uneducated. A lot of the, you know, my constituents out here that are Democrats or independents, they just feel that the government could just print more money and everything will be just fine. I don't think they understand the consequences of those actions. And I don't think we all know, obviously, the media is in the tank for Obama, that I just don't think the conservatives or the Republican Party is doing a good enough job of educating the public as far as what the consequences are for our actions, and not under, and instead of making people understand there's a difference between wanting things and needing things at this point.
Well, and I would argue as a Democrat that the same can be true on the Democratic side. If you don't make the investment in education, if you don't make the investment this, that, and the other thing, you're going to be sorry down the line. Now, the point I'm making is that both parties need to do more education. I essentially agree with your argument.
Bob, what do you think?
I think that it's absolutely true that the public is not as fully aware of the consequences of what they're doing or not doing. They don't realize how much trouble we're in, and everybody likes that part of the federal expenditures that they get a piece of.
Well, it almost sounds like to me that we've got to go back to, you know, I mean, David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, who called out austerity from the get-go and put some pretty harsh cuts into place with a coalition government based on, you know, his deputy prime minister is a raging liberal.
Yeah.
You've got to make the assumption now that maybe we have to look at Great Britain as being the great experiment and what we need to do here. Would you agree with that,
yeah,
Ralph?
Absolutely. The failure, of course, is Zimbabwe, but the experiment is going to be the Great Britain. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens. And caller, I absolutely agree with your assessment. When I go abroad to do business, one of the first things that people ask is the state of American business, what's going on with Congress, why can't they pass a budget, why can't America seem to get their fiscal situation in order. So it's a very big problem, and increased education and awareness is extremely important. So hopefully you can do your job from that end.
Well, caller, we appreciate you. We're going to put you back on hold so you can listen to some more of the show. Thanks a lot for your comment today. You know, the education, this is something that we've talked about many, many times here on Backroom Politics, is the messaging. We've been critical of the White House and the Obama administration in their messaging, but it also seems that the Republicans have not done a good job of the messaging, getting out that message themselves. We now get to a point where the uninformed electorate is now, whether you want to call it a hindrance or an anchor, Americans have got to start getting more involved in how the government is run on a daily basis. It directly affects them. And if we're hearing comments like that from the West Coast, that's not voting well, is it, Bob?
No, but and I will tell you how the public is going to get educated, I think. Once, first of all, Paul Ryan, the chairman of the Budget Committee in the House, a Republican, has put out the Republican proposed budget. It makes some serious changes in the tax policy and in the programs of the United States government. The president is about to put his program out. The budget that he offered 2 months ago is gone, prepared, because nobody paid attention to it.
Right.
He's going to put out another program. I think it's tomorrow, maybe it's Thursday, I'm not sure which, where he is going to lay out what his program is. I suppose that will be the one that the Democrats will support. Now, given that, we're going to have two major proposals on the table.
Which, by the way, is unusual.
Yes.
In the history of American government. It has always been the president issues his presidential budget request, they go into conference, they come up with deals, amendments, et cetera, and then from there, they go out and they put it to the actual floor vote. This now is a precedence that we've never seen before,
no,
where you have an opposition budget proposal and a budget proposal coming from the White House.
Yeah, you've got two full proposals out there, and that's going to mean that we're going to have a real debate. We're going to have it on the floor of the Congress. We're going to have it when folks go back home. It's going to be in the newspapers. It's going to be on television. All the cable news networks, everybody's going to have their own point of view based upon where they're coming from. But nonetheless, the public is going to learn a great deal in a relatively short time about the choices that have to be made. And obviously, the conservatives will be making one set of choices and recommending another. And the Democrats, they'll be recommending a different. But there'll be a debate.
And it'll be very interesting to see how the people react at these town halls.
Yeah.
Is that necessarily a good thing to put? I mean, basically, we're asking the American electorate to drink from the fire hose. Is that necessarily a good thing right now?
Well, it's certainly better that they get too much information, let's say, or too much, you know, conflicting information, if that is better than what they have right now. I think most people, the only thing they know about the government is they know they like some programs. They want to keep those, but all the other ones are bad programs.
And it's important to recognize that everything that we do domestically has an impact overseas, and it's important for the American people to recognize that other countries are trying to divest themselves from the dollar because they view it as a very, very weak currency.
All right, well, we're going to take a break right now. It's 20 till the top of the hour. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. God, I got to get those closers down. Stay with us. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital. This is our weekly roundtable on politics and everything, domestic, international affairs, anything you can think of. We invite you to call in. You can dial in at 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. I want to get back to the debt ceiling issue and how we're going to deal with that. I find it hard to believe, and it's something I picked up as we were talking about it before, and part of it is an educational process, like our caller stated, but the reality is, how do we get the message out to the rest of the country, the rest of the electorate that says, hey kids, it's time to tighten the belt, we don't have a choice in this matter, or else we're going to be number two, number three, possibly number four, behind countries like Russia, China, and even the EU. Al, how do we get that message out? Or is the electorate ready for that message?
The electorate's not going to be ready for that message, but I think the electorate may slowly begin to understand the message if several groups deliver the message. Members of Congress, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, and the media.
The media.
I have always defined the media in a democracy as providing the information that free people need to be able to vote intelligently. And I don't think they're doing it on this issue, along with a whole bunch of other issues. But the media should be doing with graphs and the whole bit, explaining exactly what situation we are in and put together various budgets and show what they are. I mean, it's not hard, it seems to me, to demonstrate you're going to have a tax increase, for example. You're going to have to cut programs that many people wouldn't want to cut, et cetera.
But, Bob, you know, we hear that message, but we're also dealing with an electorate that has the attention span of a gnat. Is how do we deal with today's soundbite culture and get that message to the electorate in a comprehensive, educational way?
Well, everything that Al said about who has to be in play and talking about it is accurate. There's one more. The President of the United States has to get heavily involved here.
Absolutely.
Because no matter who the President is, no matter what his politics are, no matter how popular he is or is not, the fact is that he is the President. And when he says at nine, when he you turn on your television set at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night, and he's there talking about the budget and talking about what has to happen and saying how difficult it's going to be, and everybody is going, you know, there's going to be a lot of changes. There's going to have to be everybody. If we work it out right, everybody is going to lose a little bit, but nobody is going to get really hurt bad. We're going to protect everybody, but we have to make some cuts. We have to find more revenues. Both of those things are problems that are going to be difficult for people to accept, but it's going to have to be done. And when the president leads, it forces, I mean, he is an agenda setter, and it forces everybody else to stay in the game and keep discussing the matter, just as you and Al were talking about.
But, Ralph, can we get that message out to the rest of the world without it affecting our financial credibility in the international community?
What we have to do is to be able to attract international investment into this country, and the way to do that is to show them that we are a financially stable country where people can come in and do business.
But my question then becomes: is how do we do that without selling out our current industrial complex? How do we invite manufacturers like BMW, Honda, and Toyota inside the continental United States without it affecting GM, Chrysler, and Ford?
I didn't notice them waiting to be invited.
Well, you're going to have to provide tax incentives and other opportunities.
But that sounds like to me that we're talking about tax breaks. And
look at what Russia's trying to do to bring in business. They're trying to set up Skolkovo, the Russia's equivalent of their new Silicon Valley. And a lot of major companies have said, we're going to go in there and do business.
Well,
other companies are very skeptical because of Russia's history of corruption and so forth.
Well,
and so on.
I mean, we've got a situation in Great Britain. Prime Minister Cameron, David Cameron's big initiative is what they're calling Tech City, which is largely based around the new Olympic community in downtown London. They're creating their own urban Silicon Valley right there in the heart of London. Is that feasible? Is that a feasible message? It seems to be working for the Brits. I don't know if it's working for the Russians, but where's the balance, I guess, Bob, of bringing in foreign investment without losing our own investment into our own nation?
We're not likely to lose. Let me put it this way. We're likely to lose a lot more if we don't fix the budget problems than we are if we do fix them. If we fix them, sure, we're causing some temporary pain, maybe some semi-long-term pain. But we're doing the things that tell other nations we're serious about it, we're going to take care of our problem, and we're a good place to invest if you're a company that wants to be in our market.
But Al, I go to you. We talk about, you know, we hear conversations about tax breaks. We hear the conversation. The Democrats have been rolling on General Electric, your old employer, Bob. General Electric pays little to no taxes you know, they pay minimal taxes into the grand scheme of things, and they base their argument on, well, we're investing in research and development. We're investing into our own company. We're investing in jobs.
But a lot of that is money that they have offshore.
Okay.
And the whole issue with deferral and whether they should be taxed, and how do you encourage them to bring the money back into the U.S. to stimulate growth?
Al, how do we make that balance of, well, we want you to invest here, but you're probably going to have to pay for it a little bit, or is that not feasible?
With regard to GE?
No. In regard to bringing foreign investments in, they see all the American companies getting tax breaks. They are arguably not paying their fair share.
Well, I think the answer is level the playing field by eliminating some of the tax breaks that we are giving our own people. I think there is legitimacy for tax breaks, if you want to call them that, for certain things. And I think true R&D is one of them. I think we've let a lot of things slip through loopholes that can be made to sound like investments, be made to sound like R&D, and Bob has his finger.
Bob?
There are a great many provisions in the tax code that are something that nobody knows about, and it's not because it's a secret. I mean, if you want to read the tax code, be my guest. But the fact of the matter is, these are things that were put in there at the where congressmen or senators are doing something that they think is worthwhile for their local community in some way, giving an advantage to some of their local business people who are selling overseas or hiring new employees in their districts. So there's all kind of small programs that together are billions and billions and billions of dollars. I think that one of the things you're going to see going forward is not the idea of saying, let's all raise taxes on the incomes of everybody. We can have an awful lot of money coming into the government if we just get rid of all these separate little deals for individual companies or parts of a certain area. But take, for example, agricultural. Some of the stuff we do in agriculture. I don't know how much money goes into agricultural programs, but I do know this. Most of the money that goes to farms goes to the very big commercial farms, and the family farms are getting almost nothing. Now, the great big commercial farms probably don't need that anymore if they ever did. That's a question. There's a place you could probably, just by reducing those deals, you could probably get billions of dollars in revenue into the federal treasury.
Yeah, but unfortunately right now we're in a situation where we're seeing that using the agricultural issue as a staple, we're seeing that the old family farms don't exist anymore. They're based on corporate-run agricultural centers, if you will. It's not mom getting up to make breakfast for dad.
We were paying farmers not to grow food for a very long period of time.
So, are we calling out getting rid of agricultural subsidies?
No, well, what I'm talking about is seeing to it that agricultural subsidies don't need to be paid when every bit of something you can grow, you can sell. And we're doing just fine right now. Now, sometimes there are needs to support industries. Maybe they're new, getting started, or something else. But the fact of the matter is, once things get going and you've got a big, strong economy in this particular area, the support systems can be gradually reduced or eliminated. It's not a question of blowing it all at once, but you can slowly pull it down so that people have a chance to plan. But there's no need here to support a lot of industries and a lot of the farming industry.
Al, is Capitol Hill ready to make major overhauls to the tax code the way we're talking about right here?
No, and it's not ready on a couple of grounds. It's not ready emotionally, politically to do so. But also, things are getting so complex that the greatest fear that any member of Congress has is the unintended consequence of what he does. He writes something into legislation. He has a good reason for doing it. There is nothing wrong with his goal at all. But it doesn't get written just right, and then the industry affected sends all its lawyers in. They find all the loopholes, and pretty soon the money is not going to where it was supposed to, not accomplishing what it was supposed to do. It is becoming just kind of a little trough out of what people eat.
Well, Ralph, we see a lot of countries that have gone to universal one flat rate tax, and we've heard a lot of politicians talk about flat rate taxation here in the United States to no avail. Have we seen success stories overseas where flat rate tax or a value add tax is sustainable and effective?
Well, I think the Russians have moved to a flat tax, and the Chinese are looking at that, and those are very good options for their countries. I think of that tax, when it's been implemented in Europe, it has not done much to stimulate growth and investment. What the other countries, European countries, have done that's been effective is they have very high domestic tax rates, but their international corporate tax rates are very low. So they're much more competitive internationally than the U.S. is, which has lower rates, but the international corporate tax rates is
second
behind Japan.
Al,
could I just give a specific example of the thing I mentioned just a moment ago?
Absolutely.
About money not going where it was supposed to. The wood products industry was going through a very, very difficult time. They may still be, for all I know. And so it was kind of desperate. And a program was developed that would help them. It was written in such a way that the first guy at the trough could get most of the money. And one was off the blocks so fast, make your head swim. And when it got through, there wasn't any money for anybody else in the wood products industry. So we made one company very rich, didn't help the others, and it was because it was a bad law written out of ignorance rather than an understanding of what the situation was.
Bob?
And let me go back to the agriculture issue for a minute, because I want to explain finish my point here.
Yeah.
Most of the agriculture programs are targeted toward, you know, one specific product and one specific growing thing. It's cotton, or it's shrimp, or it's wheat, or it's corn. Now, the reason those things are all in legislation is because the senators and the congressmen from the states that grow those products are not doing anything wrong. They're trying to encourage the strength of the local economy.
They still have to represent the constituents,
yeah,
in their state.
Exactly. They're doing it.
Corn for ethanol is a beautiful example.
Yeah. I mean,
a solar tax credit.
Yeah. So, you know, understand that all this stuff that's in the tax code is not done by evil people.
No.
These are people who are trying to make sure that their local economies are strong and strengthened. And if their local economy is raising cotton, then by God, they're going to try to set a foundations. You know, you get at least this much money for your cotton, or the federal government comes in and gives you some money.
All right. Well, we're coming up on the top of the hour. We're going to take a break now for 2 minutes. We invite you all to stay with us. This is Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Of the sun and west of the moon, we'll build a dream house of love. just you and I, forever and a day. Love will not die. We'll keep.
From Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It is the top of the hour, 5 o'clock here on the East Coast. And this is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room. With us, as always, our round table of political pundits, Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. And we were talking last hour about the budget, but the budget had a direct impact on the District of Columbia. We're going to get a little local here. For those of you who don't know, who may not be inside the Beltway, the mayor of Washington, D.C. and the chairman of the city council were arrested yesterday on Capitol Hill protesting the vote on the budget itself.
They wanted
to get arrested. There's no question. If you're the mayor of Washington, D.C. and you're being put in handcuffs, guess what? You wanted to do that. Capitol Police took them into custody. They were released fairly shortly thereafter. But it brings up a huge point, which we talked about last week with Joe Williams, our guest. The issue of D.C. representation in Congress is now coming to a head. This last budget really, really took a swipe at the District of Columbia's sovereignty as a political and governmental entity and how it represents its residents. We had no say in any of the maneuvering that was done regarding the, and I say we, I talk about those residents of D.C. Now then, for full disclosure, I am a resident of Washington, D.C. I can tell you, this is something that's very close to my heart. I think it is an abomination. The fact that I pay serious, serious property tax, serious income tax into the federal coffers, and I don't have a voice in Congress. So I gotta ask the question now. Are we at a point in our country's history where giving D.C. a vote in Congress is viable and real, and should it and does it need to happen? Al, let's start with you.
It should happen. It needs to happen. And let me move it a little closer to the microphone so that you can hear my strong views on this. Yes, it needs to happen. It should happen. It's not going to happen soon. The closest it came was when a fine Republican from Northern Virginia, Tom Davis, joining the delegate from Washington, D.C., Eleanor Holmes Norton, came up with a plan that solved one of the key problems, and that is D.C. is an extremely Democratic district. They're going to put a Democrat in the House. What they came up with was a plan of adding one more to a state that was clearly Republican, so that
Utah.
So that took care of the problem, and that failed. Now, if you can't get it through under those circumstances, particularly given that Tom was very well respected on the Republican side, he still couldn't pull votes. So I think it's not likely to happen soon.
And I'd like to invite anybody who's out there listening to join in the discussion. You can call us live, 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. Bob, you've been around this town a long time, and we've seen some pretty effective delegates to Congress from the District of Columbia. We've seen some very ineffective delegates from the District of Columbia. Eleanor Holmes Norton arguably is one of the more effective delegates we've had.
No doubt.
And she is absolutely adamant at this time, as she should be, that now is a time that the residents of the District of Columbia should have a voice in Congress.
Note, all she's asking for is one voting member in the House.
That's right.
At this point, they're not talking two senators. There is a statehood movement which would get there, but what she's asking for right now is essentially for her to be allowed to vote in the House.
Right, which she cannot do now. She can vote in committee, but she cannot cast a floor vote on the House of Representatives.
That's right.
So, Bob, what negative effect would this have? We're talking about one Democratic vote. Why are the Republicans so adamant about having that one Democratic vote?
You'll have to ask a Democrat. they will tell you why the Republicans are so adamant. I don't really know why they're so adamant. And I think, quite frankly, the legitimate question is how you do it. And because there's a legitimate constitutional question, which I think can be gotten around without too much difficulty.
Right.
But it does exist. And that does give people a chance to say, well, it's a matter of a constitutional issue. It is, but it can be solved. It can be solved by people of goodwill and want to do it. But I think, quite frankly, the Republicans are looking at it as this is not a state. It is the seat of government, which is how it was conceived of and why it was organized the way it was and structured the way it is. And from their standpoint, it is not a state, and it is states have rights to vote in the Congress, but none of the territories that we're talking about. And there are other territories, Guam and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and Panape, and there are other problems. Now, I personally don't have some of the feelings other people do about it, but I do understand why there are more than just let's put it this way. Tom Davis and Eleanor did a hell of a job of getting as far as they did, and they had the best solution I've yet seen.
And they had the support of Orrin Hatch. Let's be real. I mean, the Senate was behind it.
They were prepared. The senator from Utah was in support of the idea, and I think, quite frankly, it was a good idea. But it hasn't worked out because there are people who are just adamant about it, and they feel strongly, and it's hard to see how we're going to break through it.
But now we look at the constitutional question that Bob speaks of. We talk about, yes, the District of Columbia in the 1790s was created as the seat of government. It was not intended to have tax-paying residents living inside its borders back in 1790. I mean, let's be real. They built this place on a swamp along the Anacostia and Potomac Rivers. It's swampland. It's now very expensive swampland.
But it is still
It's still built on swampland.
It's now a political swamp.
There's that, too. But the constitutional question, there's no question that the constitutional question of, yes, it was designed to see the government, it should not have a voice, it would give unfair advantage to the district. The Constitution arguably is a living document in some. I happen to be an originalist, but we can amend, I know, as Al rolls his Democratic eyes at me. You and I have had the discussion that your take is it is a living and breathing document that should change the times. I would argue that the times have changed to allow, look, a large part of the revenue for this region comes out of a tax base that's based here in the District of Columbia. Should we not change the Constitution or try to get around it without too much hesitation?
Yes, absolutely. One of the reasons that I think originalism is short-sighted is that an awful lot that made sense 200 years ago simply doesn't make sense applied to a world that has changed fantastically in the last 5 years.
Right.
I mean, when did you buy your first...
I bought my place here in Washington, D.C. 2.5 years ago.
But when did you buy your first cell phone?
I bought my first cell phone in 1994.
Okay, and you were one of the first.
Right.
So, and when did you get your first iPod and your, you know...
It was one of the first, back in the early 2000s.
Okay, so much has changed. Benjamin Franklin and the other founding fathers wouldn't even recognize the country today. Now, bringing it down from the whole...
The grand scheme
and the world were the problems. The fact that Washington, D.C. has changed so much, that its citizenry has changed so much, that it's a center of commerce and wealth as well as government, all suggest that we should see if the license plates running around this town that say no representation, no taxation without representation, don't in fact have a lot of merit, constitutional merit, as a matter of fact.
Right. Ralph.
There's a lot of talk among certain circles of having D.C. revert back to Maryland and or Virginia, in effect having it become sorted into one of those two states.
Yeah, I got
the other issue, now being from Hawaii and hearing stories about when Hawaii became a state, the only way Hawaii could become a state is if, at the time, Hawaii was heavily Republican. They were to bring in a Democrat-leaning state, which was going to be Alaska.
Which was then very Democratic.
And they also had to satisfy the demands of the white Southern Democrats that didn't like Hawaii because they were very multicultural.
But I can tell you right now, as a resident of the District of Columbia, Any talk of us being absorbed in either Maryland or Virginia, before moving to the district, I lived in Virginia. I moved to the district because it has its own identity. It is really a great place to live. And that goes on the backs of a lot of the district leadership. I will even give credit to Marion Barry. I will give credit to Anthony. I know everybody here is looking at me like I've got two heads right now. There's no question that leaders like Marion Barry, there's no questions that leaders like Anthony Williams, Adrian Fenty did some great things for this city. Vince Gray has the best interests of this city at heart. I have no question. I would venture to say that by being absorbed, we lose our identity. We lose that base of being that one point of, whether you want to call it independence, whether you want to call it center of political will, however you want to call it, we lose that identity by being absorbed into a state. Now then.
Then what you're going to have to do is look at one of these other territories and bring them in together. One of the other territories being the Republican
state. So what, do we absorb American Samoa into Hawaii and we have the biggest state in the union now is Hawaii?
Well, you bring in Guam or you bring in Puerto Rico, something that will satisify the other side, so they will be willing.
Does anybody ask Maryland whether they want a whole bunch more Democrats in their state?
if you ask the congressional members around the Beltway in Maryland, they'll say absolutely.
But I mean, there's that imbalance that you have to look at. I think that many, many, many of the arguments are what I would call lawyers' arguments, and I'm not taking a cheap shot at lawyers. But lawyers think differently. They're trained to think differently, and they get all hung up, in my judgment, in distinctions without a difference very often, and. And they can be accurate in terms of the law, but throw up what amounts to a smokescreen. I think this problem could be solved. I think it could be solved if a few more Republicans would realize they weren't going to be hurt assuming it was done in a way in which they wouldn't be hurt.
Which is why my point of bringing in another territory.
Sure. I think there are a number of ways of doing it.
I think that even bringing in, you know, when we talk about the most logical proposal that we've heard, that at least that I've heard, is the idea of the delegate becoming a voting member of Congress, not giving the district two senators, but basically having one delegate with voting rights. Now, if somebody were to tell me, change the voting or change the Constitution or make an amendment or create a law that gets around the idea of we're not states, we're territories, but in my opinion, if we're paying taxes into the federal coffers, we should be able to have a voice in the House of Representatives at bare minimum. That doesn't change the construct of the U.S. Senate. You know, senators are going to be all over, well, if you give them two senators, there's two Democratic senators, you're going to change the polarization of the Senate.
That will not happen.
That will not happen. And I don't think that's realistic in what would amount to a state of 280,000 people, basically making Rhode Island not the smallest state in the union anymore. I would also venture to say that if people in Samoa, Guam, Puerto Rico are paying federal taxes, if they are paying FICA and paying into Social Security, they have a legitimate right for representation in the House of Representatives at bare minimum. I don't think that's unreasonable in my opinion, but apparently it's something that's falling on deaf ears on the Hill.
I think many of those territories that you mentioned have been given the opportunity about whether they want to pursue statehood, and they said no.
Puerto Rico has gone after statehood. I can't tell you how many times, and it's failed every time because they want to keep their individual identity, but they don't want to lose the subsidies that are given to them by the federal government.
That's right.
I believe that if we came up with a scenario that gave them a voting delegate in the House, that would be more appealing to the residents of Puerto Rico, even American Samoa and Guam and Pe. I think that would be a logical solution, in my opinion, but it's not something that is getting a lot of traction. And as a result, I got to have my mayor and my chairman of council get arrested.
Does anybody know what the politics are of these territories? Are they Democrats or Republicans or a mixture?
They're generally Democrats. I think Guam had a governor, a Republican governor, and a Republican legislature. But Samoa, Virgin Islands are
tendably Democrat. I can tell you right now, Puerto Rico is very Democratic. Yeah.
But they have a Republican.
They have a Republican governor. There's a strong Republican governor in the governor's mansion right now. There is a strong Republican presence in the legislature in Puerto Rico. However, traditionally, Puerto Rico has been a strong Democratic stronghold. But they waver. Puerto Rico is one that...
So you couldn't just... Right. Bring in voting delegates from all of them and be done with it. I used to partially represent the Virgin Islands for a brief period of time.
What? How's that?
No, as a lobbyist.
Oh. I was like, wait a minute. How did your congressional... That's gerrymandering.
When you can gerrymander the 2nd District of Washington State, the Virgin Islands.
Wow.
Yeah. And I learned some things. We treat our territories very, very badly. The Virgin Islands would be delighted to reach the economic level of the state of Mississippi, which is
right.
The poorest state in the Union. And it seems to me having some voting representation in the Congress would be the easiest and most marketplace-oriented way of helping to balance that out. But if they're all Democrats, that's not good.
Right. Now,
and the other issue with Puerto Rico is there are elements within the Republican Party that are concerned if Puerto Rico becomes a state that you're going to have more people that don't speak or read English.
Well, that's a failed argument right there concerning the fact that Caucasians are going to be second in majority to Hispanics here very quickly.
That's true, but there's a large movement among some of these Republican constituencies to push English only.
I, I, I think that's another third rail, in my opinion. Yeah. But I still think, though, that regardless of, you know, the outside fringe arguments, the baseline argument of having of being taxed without having that voice in Congress puts us as residents of the District of Columbia, and even as residents of Puerto Rico, American Samoa, Guam, it puts us at a distinct disadvantage, not only economically, but socially. It puts us at a distinct disadvantage politically.
I agree with you.
I'm telling you right now that my new soapbox over the past year has quickly become, I want representation in the floor of Congress, period.
You know, guys, I can see Justin in handcuffs with the mayor.
I will not. That won't be the first time. It was training the first time, and I'm sure it won't be the last time either. I get pretty ornery in my old age. It's now 20 past the hour. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the changes that are happening in the 2012 political arena. Big news coming out of Washington, or coming out of Utah, or Michigan, or Massachusetts, wherever you want to call it. Mitt Romney is now officially a candidate for president. We'll talk about that when we come back in 2 minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us. Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics with Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, and I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. And you can join the conversation 619-638-8477. Again, that number is 619-638-8477. We are going to talk a little bit about the presidential race in 2012, which has gotten a little bit more interesting. And I was corrected. I had made mention that Mitt Romney is now an official candidate for president. In fact, he is still unofficial. He has only formed his exploratory committee, which does not, in fact, make him an official candidate because he has yet to file his paperwork officially with the Federal Elections Commission.
But it's pretty fair to say that anybody who has an exploratory commission is ready to go.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is not real big news, but it does change a little bit of the dynamic of what's going to happen here in the 2012 race. Let's talk a little bit about Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney is the second one to form a committee behind Tim Pawlenty, and Tim Pawlenty has already come out strong with his movie theater Jerry Bruckheimer-esque type video, and Mitt Romney kind of came out not so strong. I think it was kind of almost inferred that, hey, you know I'm coming. But when we talk about Mitt Romney, Al, Mitt Romney has been the longtime de facto front runner for the Republicans for a long time. We've seen other names come up. I mean, Donald Trump, for example, is I know, but he's still running second. He's still running second to Romney. But when we look at Mitt Romney, a lot of the questions that are coming up about him is the healthcare issue in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Is that a red herring, or is there some legitimacy in that argument against him being president?
Well, I think for a lot of ultra-conservatives who didn't like the federal health care bill, which is not totally dissimilar from what he put on in Massachusetts, it puts them in a bind. And they would rather have somebody who didn't have their fingerprints all over something that they are committed to repealing at the federal level. So I think, yeah, that hurts it. I think another thing that may or may not hurt him, it annoys me so much that I'm not objective on whether this is bothering other people. Mitt Romney is clearly a man very qualified to be president by reason of his career, education, background, etc. But I am very troubled with a man who can go from being the liberal Republican governor of Massachusetts to trying to tie down the right wing of the next time when he ran for president.
Right.
Who knows where he's going to be? That's not just a shift of position. That is a wholesale abandonment of one pretty clear philosophical view for another one for a reason that looks incredibly opportunistic. So I don't trust it. And I'm wondering if there aren't a lot of people who admire him and are closer to him politically, in ideology, than I am, have a trust issue with him as well.
Bob, what do you think?
I think that Al has put his finger on what is the biggest question for Mr. Romney, and that is, you know, what does he believe? And no matter what he says, I think there are people who say, well, you know, you said one thing on this. One thing, you know, you're on one side of here and you're on another side over here. It's not a positive for him, and I think
they're hopping from really kind of one almost extreme to the other. Yeah. It's not just an adjustment.
I don't disagree with that. I can tell you right now that I supported Romney in the first election. I supported him in 2008. I backed him because of the fact that I backed him because of his tenure in Massachusetts. I used to call myself a Mitt Romney-esque type Republican, a more centrist, a more moderate Republican, which as the governor of a liberal state like Massachusetts, you did well. I had hoped that he had, you know, learned from that and saying, look, there is a large population of the Republican Party that will back you, that will get behind you because we're tired of the far right constantly holding the party at bay. Mm-hmm. That being said, I think that maybe he may have learned his lesson. I hope he's learned his lesson. And that, you know, as long as he sticks to, look, the health care bill he passed in Massachusetts is not unlike the proposal that came out of Richard Nixon's White House in 72. It is not unlike anything else that other Republicans have backed. That being said, if he sticks to the economy, if he sticks to the financial stability of the American government and the America as a whole, I think he has some plausible qualities that will offset the argument of, well, he's a waffler. He, you know, you might as well just throw him in and put whipped cream and strawberries on him. He's a Belgian waffle. Is that realistic, Bob, or am I living in a dream world?
I don't know. I don't honestly know. He has, I think, a good following within the party, but I don't know that he has what it takes to win the nomination.
And how does he leap from liberal to conservative to moderate?
He's really alienated the conservative base, many of whom are looking at.
Well, he was never a conservative within the terms of what the conservatives are talking about
right
now.
And when we talk about the conservatives, let's be clear.
Yeah.
We're talking about the right-wing side of the party.
He has never been that. He has always been what I would call a moderate Republican.
His father was that way as governor of Michigan.
Yeah. But most of his philosophy was what I would call moderately conservative.
Right.
Yeah. But that is a very slim piece of the party.
I think as a candidate in the last presidential election, he moved much farther to the right than Bob does.
I would agree.
But the bottom line is, can he balance the budget? Can he use his business skills and acumen to help the economy?
Can he make the argument that he can do that?
Yes. Right.
And I'm just questioning the I'm bringing up the trust issue.
Yeah, and I think that's legitimate.
I do, but here's the problem, is as a Republican candidate for the highest office in the United States, if you're running as a Republican, you have to at least acknowledge the presence of the far right wing, which I'm not a big fan of, I'll tell you that right now. But if it's a difference of somebody abandoning the far right platform in order to talk sensible economic, I mean, look, let's be real. Mitt Romney brought the Salt Lake City Olympics from the brink of bankruptcy back to financial prevalence.
Sure.
He has done it with many different corporations. He is a successful businessman and has the credentials.
No question about his capability.
And honestly, I think the trust issue is only based on media perception of having to count out. I blame the party more than I blame him for having to do that, because I think he was pressured by the party, in my opinion.
And the party has also not backed him when people were coming out against his religion.
Another factor.
It's unfortunate, but it is
unfortunate.
It just drives me nuts that anyone would even bring it up.
In this day and age, it's surprising, but let's look at the reality of our electoral base. There are still a lot, you know, it's not unlike the question of John F. Kennedy in 1960 of him being a Catholic. The country, quote-unquote, at that time wasn't ready for a Catholic to be president.
That's exactly right. But in this case, he's got a very strong fundamentalist Christian group in the Republican Party that he has to deal with. Kennedy had to deal with his Catholicism broadly,
right?
Because there were anti-Catholic bigots everywhere. I think he had liberal anti-Catholic bigots.
Right.
He's got an important part of his own party that cares a lot. I don't know how many Democrats give a damn one way or another. I've never seen a poll on that.
And Mormons have always been very loyal to the Republican Party, so it's kind of an interesting conundrum.
It is. But I think Bob, we're kind of shrucking a legitimate candidate for president. I mean, if we're going to use a trust issue, okay, bring that forward. We can offset that. But if you're going to question somebody's religion, I honestly believe that this country, at least I hope, this country is far more advanced in its tolerance of freedom of religion, and the basis of our American governance that we can say, okay, you know what, whether you're a Mormon, a Jew, you know, whether you're an Anglican or a Catholic, it does not matter. You know, as long as you meet the criteria and you can prove to the American populace that you are qualified to be president, let the media go.
The real test will be when an atheist runs for president.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That one, that's a whole nother show.
Right.
That's a whole nother show.
And we're a lot of years away from it being
I don't think we're going to see that in either your lifetime or even mine, for that matter.
That's right.
Let's
talk about that again, because I didn't say what I said to be the definitive analysis of him. I think he's a strong candidate. I think he is probably the candidate that everybody else is going to have to defeat to get the nomination. But I was just pointing out some of the weaknesses that he's going to
have. No, I know. We understand that, and we should point those out.
Yeah, but his record of achievement, both politically and as a business person, is very exemplary. I mean, he truly has the credentials to be a good president, were he to be the president.
Absolutely, absolutely.
No doubt about it.
Absolutely. I mean, and, you know, and the funny thing about it is, you know, the one thing that, you know, we hear out of the far right, family values, let's be honest, Mitt Romney has a huge family. He's got, what, 12 or 14 children. I mean,
in the last election cycle, he was the only one of the Republican candidates that had one wife.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
You
would
say it so nicely.
Al was about to get smacked here in the smoke-encrusted nerve center of backroom politics.
I'm going to make it a bad joke.
We have a phone caller. Caller, you're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
No, thank you for joining us. What can we do for you?
Well, I was just thinking about the proposed government shutdown. I mean, I haven't been following it that closely, but I just kind of had the thought, would it really be that bad if the government actually shut down? I mean, technically, it would be a good thing, wouldn't it?
How so? How do you come up with it being a good thing?
Well, I mean, obviously, the federal government specifically has been doing all sorts of despotic things and passing bills that the majority of people actually don't want for their own special interests. So technically, and since Congress is basically filled with a bunch of pedophiles and other people trying to rape the pages, I mean, wouldn't it actually be kind of a good thing that they stop passing all these statutes which limit our liberty?
Thank you very much for your call, sir. If you're gonna here's the thing on that. If you're gonna call that out, this is not the venue for it. We're very much about civil discourse, but when you throw out words like you threw out, caller, we're not gonna have that. But appreciate you listening. Going back to the original point when we were talking about Mitt Romney and his candidacy for president. When we look at some of the other runners that are out there, I mean, Tim Pawlenty, we said, has an exploratory committee. Donald Trump is something that's got – I mean, everybody's laughing at the table, but I got to tell you, as a Republican, you have to look at Donald Trump as being somewhat viable. He's got the money to do it.
But you know what's given him a lot of traction is the issue of Obama's birth certificate.
Well, this brings up the birthers issue, and that's something I don't agree with. I mean, let's be real. He's been certified by
the state of Hawaii has certified that Obama was born in Hawaii.
He was part of the census then.
That should have ended it.
But you know, when we look at somebody like Donald Trump, what concerns me about that is we're getting to a point now where we're seeing celebrity candidates, where they have to be celebrities in order for them to be viable candidates, and they use that celebrity to get a platform. Does that not disturb you a little bit, Bob, or am I making too much out of it?
I think he's the modern version of Ross Perot. He's got a lot of money. He's a smart guy. And he can certainly make...
He has hair.
Oh, does he have hair. I don't think he is... really a serious candidate. I don't know exactly why he's doing it. I don't want to think it's just ego. I think there's more to it than that. But, I mean, just think about all the things he's involved in that he'd have to stop doing once he, you know, does anything at all formally, even an exploratory committee. And at the same time, he's out there, you know, making business deals and running his business. And I don't think he's a serious.
I saw him on
serious
the,
candidate.
On the
I just
view.
Don't.
You wait, you were watching. Wait a minute. Wait. I want to hear that again. You saw him where?
On The View.
We got to get you out of the house, Mark. No, we really do.
Must be the gorgeous woman on The View.
Barbara Walters.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Whoopi
Goldberg. I'm enchanted. Really into 70-year-old cute women.
All right. Hi, Paula. So, anyway, you saw him on The View.
I saw him on The View, and I got the impression that he was having a ball. I think he's doing this for fun.
Oh, I do too.
Well, I got a problem with that. I mean, if he's doing this as a hobby, if he's doing it for fun, look, if he is in fact the next Ross Perot, Ross Perot did it for the right reasons, and Ross Perot, in his mind, don't laugh, Bob, he did it.
I thought it was for very right.
Thank you, Al.
Okay. I got to tell you. If in fact, Ross Perot, I think, legitimately ran because he legitimately felt that he could best serve as President of the United States.
I agree.
I don't think that Donald Trump is running for no other reason than he is a media hound.
Here's the real issue. Donald Trump has had several bankruptcies. How can you ask someone like that to be able to run a country in a balanced budget?
Ooh, good point.
You know, I'm not, this is not a personal attack against him.
But he's come back from them. Maybe that's the man we actually need.
Yeah, he's somebody who can bankrupt the corporation.
Three times? If he was trying to do business in China, they would never allow it.
They came back three times.
I know. Al's promoting the Democratic platform of, hey, you know what, bring him along. He can fiscally fix, the Trump Taj. Why not America? Looking at some of the other candidates that are out there.
I'd like to talk about Huckabee for just a minute.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about. I was going to bring up, looking at some of the other candidates, some of the names that have kind of slipped by. Is one of them is Governor Huckabee.
Governor Huckabee struck me in the last campaign as an ultra-conservative with no sharp edges. He was civil. He was always civil.
Correct.
He was funny. He was relaxed. He, I think, could get to a lot of people where your hard right ideologues could not, even though he's hard right. And then I was utterly astonished. He's a Baptist minister, and he couldn't get the Christian right to support him. What do they want, you know?
That's a good question. I mean, Huckabee has literally been on the fence longer than some birds I know out by my house. And
except on social issues. He's very conservative.
No, he's very conservative. No, but he's been on the fence about pulling the trigger on actually forming an exploratory committee. Is he going to run? It's a question he's been asked numerous times. And he's kind of struck those answers.
And he's not doing very much to indicate he is.
No, as a political operative inside the Beltway, Bob, are you seeing that as maybe he's just waiting for the right time, or legitimately is he making so much money right now it would be silly for him to come off that talking head circuit and start, you know, politicking for the White House?
Well, I don't know whether
that's the pigeonhole for Sarah Palin, you know, can be. Put two pigeons in that bowl.
It's a very small hole.
Her problem is she's become too much of a celebrity that people aren't going to take her seriously if she tries to come back.
There's no question. I mean, Glenn Beck, who we'll talk about in a second, even Glenn Beck says that Sarah Palin has hurt her own brand by doing reality shows and the sort. But, are we looking at him just really kind of waiting in the wings and then saying, ha, you know what, I've decided I'm going to run for president?
I haven't the faintest idea, but if I had to guess, I would guess that he's not going to run.
Why?
Because I think that he is enjoying what he's doing. He's certainly making some money, but I think he really absolutely likes what he's doing. And I think that he's took a shot once before and it didn't work, and I don't think he's going to try again.
And he knows how hard it is.
Very
hard it is to raise all the money and do all the travel.
Let me throw another name on the table.
Okay.
And I think this guy would, I have no idea whether he is seriously interested at all. But I mean, to my mind, he would be a superb president. Whether he could be elected or not, I don't know.
Who's that?
But the governor of Indiana,
Stanhope,
is wonderful.
I will tell you that
Mitch Daniels is as good as they come as far as knowing policy. He's worked as budget chief for the president. He has had several other jobs, major administrative jobs over the last several decades. He has he's been governor of Indiana, which is one of the most stable and sound economically states in the union. He has done, and they've had a tough time too because they've had a lot of auto and steel workers
right,
there,
but,
and he's done a marvelous job of holding everything together, and he is one hell of a bright and able guy.
Mitch Daniels fell into the well that Walker did in Wisconsin, and governor of Ohio,
Kasich
fell into in the trying to pull collective bargaining out of state government. I think that's something that could be his big Achilles heel. And unfortunately, labor has a very, very strong, sharp memory, and they remember that. I don't think he could fight the labor movement in total and still expect to get to the White House. I'm not
arguing the case. I'm just telling you, I think he would be one very gifted person.
I think that he would be gifted. I'm a huge, huge fan of Chris Christie in New Jersey. We were talking earlier before. Chris Christie's already said he is not running. He is dedicated to being the governor of New Jersey, which I think is admirable. Chris Christie, you know, he's the type of guy that I would love to see president. He's basically my size, and he's in the governor's mansion. And he basically, I mean, this is a guy who, the greatest story I heard about Chris Christie was when he was U.S. attorney in New Jersey having some political corruption issues with their elected officials. Basically came out, had a whole press conference, all of his justice people, all of the FBI, all state police, everybody there, state's attorney, everybody's there, and he comes out and he says, okay, look, whatever you elected officials did before today is water under the bridge. I don't care. From today on, make note, I'm looking for you. If you take an envelope with cash in it for a political deal, make no mistake about it, there's a strong chance that money came from me. I will find you, I will arrest you, prosecute you to the fullest extent, and you will do time. That's the type of guy I want to see in the White House. I am a huge fan of Chris Christie, so I'm waiting for 2016. That's assuming that my friend Mitt Romney does not get elected in 2012. I would say that if Mitt Romney is elected, we will see possibly another 16 years. We will see another 16 years of Republican rule in the White House. Mark my words.
Interesting thought.
Just a thought. We're coming up in the last 10 minutes. We're going to take a quick one-minute break. When we come back...
Can we come back and talk about the dwarfs?
The dwarfs? What about the dwarfs?
Seven dwarfs. The dwarfs. Well,
the other
Sarah Palin and other nutty people.
That wasn't very civil, Al. Other people with opinions that are disparate from yours.
Other people associated with planters.
You know what? Scratch the break. Let's just keep going. We're on a roll here now. Al's lit up right now for the last 10 minutes. We're going to go into our freeform section. One of the things we were talking about before the show for the last 10 minutes is I am a fan of the Masters. That is must-see TV for me every year. Bob and I were talking before the show. I got to tell you something. I want to give a shout-out to Rory McIlroy. Rory, this kid, 21-year-old kid from Northern Ireland, comes out to the Masters, his first big major, and comes out and runs the table for the first three rounds of golf, comes out on the front nine, okay, holds his lead, hits a horrible shot on 10 and just melts down unlike we've seen since Greg Norman in 96. Instead of running to the clubhouse, instead of thwarting all of the media attention, he actually showed his mettle and came out and was a class act.
Absolutely.
I will tell you, there's a lot of politicians in this town that could learn from that. He really showed his mettle. Really showed. I think we're going to see a lot more of Rory McIlroy. Bob, what do you think of that?
Well, as a golfer who is enthusiastic but unfulfilled, I would say this about it. I think that I saw a young man who's going to have one hell of a great career. I think he learned a great deal about himself and the pressures of major golf, major tournament golf at the Masters, and he handled it beautifully, both as a player for three rounds and as someone who came apart and stood up and talked about it after the tournament was over. I thought I was stunned at the maturity of the young man.
Oh my gosh! And the fact is, you know, the funny thing about it that I noticed is, this is a young man who took responsibility. He said, look, it was my fault. The pressure got to me. I take full acceptance of what happened.
Yeah, I did it.
It was solely, it was mine to lose, and I lost it. You know, Greg Norman didn't have that kind of class when he lost in 96.
Yeah.
This is somebody I hope to see around the PGA for a long time to come.
Well, he's 21 years old. He hits the ball a mile. He putts beautifully. He's got a great golf game. I think you're going to see him for 20 years.
I hope so.
And he's going to win. I'll bet he wins a minimum of a half dozen majors.
I hope so. I really do. Just really came out of the box as a really sharp, sharp golfer and a real class act.
So when's he going to play with John Boehner?
When is he going to play with John Boehner?
John's so busy.
Speaker Boehner, not so much on the golf course these
John's
days.
John's a little busy.
Who are we talking about?
We're talking about Rory McIlroy. He is a 21-year-old kid from Northern Ireland.
What does he do?
He's a golfer, Al.
Oh.
he's not running for president.
He's not political, Al. This is just us in freeform.
I once did around at for at 100.
So I do that routinely.
For nine holes. And I quit.
And you quit, as well you should.
Al, that was a very good decision.
I hope you still don't have those clubs. We're going to go right now, last 7 minutes of the show, we're going to go around the table and tell me a story. Since the last one we had was scooped by you, we're going to go ahead and we're going to go Ralph Winnie. Tell me a story.
Okay. Colombia, Panama, and South Korea will sign free trade agreements with the U.S. by this summer.
Really?
Yes.
Are we expanding NAFTA into an AFTA?
Maybe so.
Wow.
My inside sources tell me Colombia, Panama, and South Korea are going to have these trade agreements signed by the summer.
Are these agreements going to include most favored nation status?
That remains to be seen.
Wow, that's a good one. Oh, wow, Bob, you got your... as Ralph stretches in victory, apparently. Bob, what do you got? Tell me a story.
The minority whip of the House of Representatives, Mr. Steny Hoyer, has indicated to several people that he may not be willing to vote for the budget deal that was put together by the president, the Senate leader, and the speaker.
Really?
Yes, he's indicated he's not very happy with some of the provisions, and he may not, be able to vote for it.
That is huge. That is a huge, huge come out.
What did he say?
Bob, you want to reiterate that one again for Congressman Al?
Steny has indicated that he may not be able to vote for the budget deal.
Steny has said he may not be able to vote for the budget deal.
Wow.
No, it's just May.
I was going to say, if in fact that's true, that is a huge statement by Steny Hoyer, which he is not above making huge statements, as we've seen in his career. But that's a huge testament to the confusion that's going on in the budget process.
Yes.
Would he survive in Democratic leadership if he does not vote for it?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I haven't the faintest idea how it would go. But he's apparently upset about some of the provisions, and I don't know what he's upset about or how deeply he's upset. But I have understood that he has indicated he's concerned about the package of state.
Wow.
He may not be able to vote.
Al, could Steny Hoyer survive, or could he be unthroned in minority leadership?
I was going to give as my line to predict that next week I wouldn't have to leave to go to the bathroom as often as I have. But Bob has just raised another one. I think that, and I guess this is contrary to how the others see, I think Nancy Pelosi may now have to vote against the budget.
Because, really?
Because I think there may be more popularity for the Steny Hoyer position in the caucus than we think. And Nancy, if he's got any shot of ever taking her on, this might be a good move on his part.
Wow.
I didn't say that.
Wow. Yeah, Bob would like on the record that the views and expressions of Al Swift do not reflect those
that last
of
point,
Bob Hine.
The ones about going to the bathroom.
No. Wow. Great stories this week. I think those are going to be stories that we're going to be talking about here in the coming weeks. Ralph, keep an eye on that on those trade agreements. I think those are going to have huge impacts on what's going on. And what are those countries again? Panama, Colombia, and South Korea.
Yes. U.S. will sign free trade agreements with those three countries by this summer.
That's going to send the Democrats up a wall.
By this summer.
The reason they haven't been passed, they haven't been adopted before, is because the Democrats are so upset about it.
And all three are allies of the U.S.
A Democrat who voted for the one with Mexico and Canada.
Right.
And I got to tell you, my labor people win. Totally nuts.
I was going to say, I hope that those embassies are ready for huge, huge, huge voicings by labor here in the United States. In the last few minutes, as always, we invite you to check out the website, www.firstcongress.org. We urge you to get involved, get active in all things political. They affect you, they affect your family, they affect everything going on in your neighborhood. We also urge you to get vocal, vote always, and learn
something about the issues.
Learn something about the issues. Get involved. Take personal responsibility for your governance.
And have fun.
Yeah, there's nothing saying you can't have fun. We certainly do. On behalf of Congressman Al Swift, the Honorable Bob Hines, Dr. Ralph Winnie, I'm your moderator, Justin Russell. We will be here next week at 4 o'clock, live from Shelley's back room. Bob?
The place to be.
Here at 1331 F Street in Washington, D.C.
For the best cigars in town.
That's right. That's right. Hey, Joe, bring me a Jack Daniels. We're calling it a day. We'll see you next week on Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. Have a great week.